Hey, this is David Sirota, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiplett, and you are listening to episode number 206 of your favorite podcast, Walking the Floor. I guess I kind of lied last time when I said I was going to not do this and take a big long break and put it on hiatus. So, I mean, I didn't exactly say that, but I kind of alluded to that, and that's probably not going to be true, I guess, because look, here we are. We're back. But I think it's going to be something like this, just kind of take interviews here and there when they pop up that are interesting. And this one today was very interesting because this is not a musical interview. We didn't talk at all about music, I don't think. Not one little bit, which is super interesting to me, but maybe less interesting to you. I will warn you folks out there that get upset when I talk politics or interview people about politics. This is not an episode for you. Turn it off, delete it off your iPhone. And for those of you who are a little more brave and interested in that sort of thing, continue on, because it's a good one. It's a really, really, really good one. Okay, lots has gone on since my last episode. We had that wonderful weekend out there in Cleveland at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Much hoopla and good times surrounding that. Thank you for all the well wishes and congratulations and all that sort of thing. And also, I announced a few solo gigs coming up. So I got December 30th. At the Soho up in beautiful Santa Barbara, my hometown. Tickets are on sale now. Go to my website, check that out. And we just added two shows opening up for Donovan Frankenreiter down south at the Coach House in San Juan Capistrano on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day night. And I believe those are on sale too. I don't even know if we're officially announced on that, but I'm announcing it here. That is happening. So three shows in a row. It's going to be fun. Good, fun way to end the year and start the new one. All right, that's enough about that. Let's get to today's interview. Here we go. All right, today we are talking politics with my guest, Mr. David Sirota, who just put out a fantastic 8-part podcast called Meltdown. That's about the 2008 financial crisis and really more specifically the Obama administration's response to it. He worked on it with Alex Gibney, the documentarian. It's really, really good. I dare say it's important if you want to understand sort of how we've gotten into the mess that we've gotten into in American politics. Sirota is a writer and a journalist in the muckraker tradition. He's written a bunch of books. He runs an independent media outlet called The Daily Poster that I also subscribe to and highly recommend. He was a senior advisor and speechwriter for the Bernie Sanders campaign. And if that's not enough, he actually co-wrote the story for the new Adam McKay movie that's coming out called Don't Look Up. That's like this star-studded Hollywood blockbuster with Meryl Streep, Leonardo DiCaprio, Jonah Hill, Jennifer Lawrence. It's insane. I think that's where we started off on today's episode, which was, by the way, the first interview that I've done in person since COVID happened. This is Mr. David Sirota on Walking the Floor.
So the movie's called Don't Look Up. It's a movie with Adam McKay, who's the director, screenwriter. Okay. I helped create the story for it. I was a co-producer. It is starring Leonardo DiCaprio, Meryl Streep, Cate Blanchett, Jennifer Lawrence, Jonah Hill, Tyler Perry, Rob Morgan, a whole...
Star-studded.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I mean, I was going to get to this eventually, because I was going to ask you, how did you connect with Alex Gibney?
Yeah.
You know, and is in you know, I've watched obviously a lot of his stuff,
yeah.
and it's great, and he makes great documentary movies, but I don't remember him ever doing something that got into this territory of sort of pushing back against, you know, sort of like Democratic Party, you know, modern liberal orthodoxies, which, you know, gets you in a lot of heat these days.
Yes, you're talking about Meltdown.
Meltdown, yeah, yes. Yeah. I'm not yeah. This, not this movie, yeah. but I think I've heard. I don't know McKay, McKay, but I heard that just through the grapevine of sort of, you know, lefties, that he's a lefty as well. So
I would say he's populist, meaning
right.
he did The Big Short,
right?
He did Vice,
right?
And before that, he did Anchorman,
sure.
Step Brothers,
sure.
And this movie is a movie about an asteroid is headed towards Earth, and it's two scientists on a media tour to try to warn the world that we need to do something. And I think some people read it, interpret it as a climate movie. Other people interpret it as a pandemic movie. But what it really is a movie about whether we as a society can... Do we have the capacity anymore to communicate with ourselves, each other, constructively? Or has the media discourse and social media and the like so tribalized and divided our society that we can't even agree and stipulate basic facts to make rational decisions?
Yeah, the answer is no, we can no longer make rational decisions, clearly.
Right, and so...
Sadly. So, I mean, I was going to get to that, too. I mean, that's like been... You know, over the years, I used to be one of those people that thought, you know, God, people are so misled, and if they just knew the truth, you know, they'd make the right decision or, you know, act rationally. But, you know, and I'm referring more to the sort of democratic side of life, because that's where I live and that's who I'm surrounded by, you know. And I've just kind of come to the conclusion over the last few years, like, this stuff works. The propaganda works because people want it.
Yes. I mean, I think that people want to have their priors reinforced. They want to be told that they're right. They don't want to have a challenge of their thinking. And I think the problem with that is that you can get ensconced in a bubble and not really be in touch with the world as it is. And I think, look, I think the Republicans and the right are, that phenomenon is way worse and way more dangerous with the Republicans. But I think when it comes to denying science or denying medical science or climate science or whatever, when you're having a debate with people, not all conservative people, but when you're having a debate with like kind of hardcore conservative Republican politicians and the like, you may be having one discussion about science and facts, and they're having a discussion about ideology, almost religious, right? I mean, if you don't think climate change is happening or it's no big deal or you don't...
I would push back on that a little bit. Like, I mean, I think it's the two sides are delusional and engage in sort of fantasy thinking just over different issues. I mean, believing something that's like demonstrably false is just delusional. It just sort of doesn't matter what it is.
What do you think the Democrats believe in that are demonstrably false?
Oh, Russiagate. I mean, they're all range of the, you know, that I mean, we can, there's a lot.
Yes.
There's a lot there.
Taking the grains of truth and spinning them into wild narratives and theories. I agree that happens across ideologies.
Right.
Absolutely. I think that I would say this. I think the Republicans have a we can't even acknowledge basic facts problem.
Right.
And I think the culture of the Democratic Party, which I agree with you, that there can be various fact-free narratives whipped up, but I think the bigger problem with the Democratic Party's culture is that it never wants to self-reflect.
Right.
It never wants to... It increasingly doesn't want to acknowledge the phenomenon of economic class in America.
Right.
That there is this whole movement essentially to say that, you know, the Democratic Party can be pro-equality when it comes to quote-unquote social issues. Gender issues, civil rights, civil liberties, which are all important issues. Let's be clear about it. They're important issues.
100%.
But to the exclusion of... When it's used to the exclusion of we need to help working people, we need to focus on working people, we need to push and be for policies that are for working people and are not for our rich donor class, that's where the Democratic Party has a real problem.
Well, that's sort of what woke, you know, sort of identity politics, modern liberalism is. It's exactly what you're saying without any class analysis at all. And I think to go back to what you were saying a second ago, I think that's a really important, that's why this Your Meltdown podcast is so important and such a great companion piece to like Tom Frank's Listen Liberal and Taibbi's, you know, Hate Incorporated, you know, Stoller's Goliath, like all these books that are just kind of covering, you know, related issues. I think not only have the party itself, but the party's rank and file, sort of professional class liberal Democrats, have no ability or no interest in sort of reckoning with the policies of their party from the last 40 years or so, but really, like, specifically, no desire to reckon with the Obama administration's response to the financial crisis.
No, it's a taboo topic.
And the reason that Clinton lost in 2016.
That's right.
You know, I mean, that's that to me. That, and to go back to what you said a minute ago, the sort of magical thinking. You know, what's the liberal side of that? I think it's exactly that. It's this total just blind spot to you know, it's this Republicans bad, Democrats right. good thing framework.
But ask the question why. Like, why is that the attitude? And I would argue that it is that way for two reasons. One, I think there's a tribalism. We don't like to self-reflect about the potential failings of our own dear leaders, if you will. I think the other part is that to ask the question, what did we do wrong after the financial crisis? What did we do wrong to create the conditions for Trumpism to rise up? You have to ask painful questions or politically inconvenient questions that might put you at odds with the big money interests that are bankrolling your party. So, in specific, why didn't the Democrats do a better job of delivering for working people and challenging Wall Street after the financial crisis? I would argue there's a direct line from Barack Obama received the most amount of money from Wall Street, and big shocker, he got into office and made sure that Wall Street really was not held accountable. And you have to then, in order to have that analysis, you have to be willing to acknowledge those facts. And if you acknowledge those facts, if you're a Democratic Party operative, politician, you're acknowledging the inherent tension, the inherent contradiction of the Democratic Party, which is the tension between telling voters we want to help you and telling donors we're going to help you. Like, right. Those two things are in conflict.
Right. Do you view that, is that corruption or is that like ideological capture?
That's right. I'm so glad.
Because, I mean, it's so obviously corruption, but do you think that people, you know, like Clinton and Obama and Pelosi and Schumer and these people, do you think that they sincerely believe that they're making the right policy choices to help people?
The distinction between corruption and capture, well, one, corruption and capture are not at odds with each other. Enough corruption can create capture. And by that, I mean, there's corruption where we think of as like, there's sweaty balls, a pile of cash in an envelope that's given to a legislator to get them to vote for something or pass that's, you know, corruption.
Right.
Capture is, let's immerse the system in so much money. Let's have a system of literally legal or figuratively legalized bribery. And let's make elections, how you win an election is just to raise enough, as much money as possible. That it goes from corrupt individual actions to a culture. That is the culture, is the way, the formula by which everybody gets elected is a moneyed formula. And that creates capture. And by that I mean, what ultimately ends up happening is that the way things are thought about, the assumptions baked into how decisions are made, are all based on making sure money is pleased at the end of the day. So to answer your question on Schumer, I don't think they wake up every day and say, how can I protect my Wall Street donors and hurt working people?
Right.
I think they wake up every day and say, listen, I'm from morning until night, I'm talking to people in that world, in that moneyed world. And all of them are giving me these policies, X, Y, Z policy that I should push in exchange for money. And those policies sound good. they're being portrayed as pragmatic, realistic, and good. And so I'll pick from that menu because that's a menu of options that purports to help people, and my donors say they're okay with. And now I feel good. I feel like I'm doing the right thing. The problem is that what's not even being considered? What's right. not on that menu?
Right.
Right? And
right.
what's not on that menu just is just not in the conversation at all. And so I think they probably think that they're doing either the best they can or they're doing the good thing. I don't think, and I'm not saying, look, I'm not saying Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are Dr. Evil, but to use a metaphor, I don't think Dr. Evil wakes up. All these people, they don't. Dr. Evil doesn't wake up and think he's, I mean, maybe he does because his name is Dr. Evil, but
right.
most run-of-the-mill Dr. Evils don't wake up and say, I'm here to do evil.
Yeah.
They create there's a creation of a thought process where they think they're doing good.
Right. I mean, it's interesting, and you talk about this in Meltdown, you know, the idea that, you know, in the context of re-regulating Wall Street and the financial services industry, that the Obama administration just wanted to hold something up to say we did this.
Right, exactly.
You know, regardless of the fact that, well, it's actually full of holes and, right. you know, we put Chris Dodd in charge of, you know, re-regulating the banks, which yeah. is totally
like the banker's senator is the namesake of the Dodd-Frank bill. It's incredible.
I mean, why do you think I think the reason that your podcast is so important is because we're just living through a different version of it right now.
Yes.
You know, when you see, and I give the Biden administration credit for doing some stuff that I think was unexpectedly great so far, like
for sure.
especially on antitrust and some labor issues
for sure.
and things, you know, so, you know, don't want to poo-poo them too much, but you see just as an institution of power, or one half of it, you know, the Democratic Party. You just look at this first year of his administration and how long it's taking to get anything done, and splitting the infrastructure bill into two, and all this stuff it's like they haven't learned that lesson, or don't even care to learn the lesson.
Well,
that you actually have the policy outcomes are connected to support from the voting public. Like you actually, if I was Joe Biden, or you know, one of the top people in his administration, the first order of business would be like, we have to at least be perceived as delivering some red meat to voters that actually positively impacts their lives. Like, why is that so hard for these people to figure out?
It's such a good question, and I think that part of it, I would say that there's two things. One, to actually deliver for working people, mm-hmm. you have to be willing to make the people sponsoring your campaigns somewhat uncomfortable and unhappy. I've said this before, I'll say it again. The reason the Democratic Party sounds so incoherent so often is because it is simultaneously telling voters it's going to fix problems, and then also trying to protect the corporate donors that created those problems. So if you try to do that, you sound incoherent, because many of these issues are binary.
Right.
Many of these issues, there is no third way. Example, and you mentioned the bills in Congress right now. When it comes to lowering medicine prices in America, where we pay the highest prices for prescription drugs in the world, you have one of two choices. Either you're going to use policy tools to lower the price of medicines. You're going to, for instance, let Medicare use its bulk purchasing power to negotiate lower prices, which the drug companies don't want, because that would require the drug companies to accept slightly lower profits. Or you're going to allow prices to remain high. You're going to serve your pharmaceutical industry donors by letting them continue. That is a binary choice. There is no third way on that choice. And so ultimately, if you go out and tell voters you're going to lower prescription drug prices and then you protect your pharmaceutical industry donors, you're just going to piss voters off. That's a recipe for people feeling frustrated. And the worst danger is that if you go out and try to sell something that didn't fix the problem, hey, we solved the problem. We passed this little we watered it down. People are going to be like, wait a minute, you're lying to me, because right. I don't feel that I'm still going to the pharmacy and getting gouged, right?
Like, yeah.
Like, and I think that the party, the people in the party at that high level don't want to admit that it's a binary choice. because it forces them into conflict with powerful actors. If you have to, if you're them, you want to believe, hey, there's a way I can make Pfizer, Amgen, all these Merck, all these pharmaceutical giants happy so that they give me money and don't fund the opposition. And there's a way for me to do that and go to voters and say, hey, I solved the problem of Pfizer, Merck, Amgen gouging you. But you want to believe that that exists, but that's a unicorn. That right. doesn't exist. And so what you end up doing is, typically what the Democrats have done is sided with the money on the formula. Well, at least if I side with the money, I don't deliver for voters. At least the money will give me money to try to win the election.
Right.
They don't want to try to... The flip side is, I'm going to try to win the election. I'm going to upset big money. But I'm going to try to win the election by... I know money's going to spend against me, but I'm going to deliver so much help to voters that I'm going to go to voters and say, look, they're attacking me. They're spending all this money because look at what I just delivered for you.
Right.
Right. And look, I kind
of... Sort of the Sanders model. I mean, like,
yes,
you know, look what I'm going to deliver for you. Yes. And I'm going to be the one guy that challenges.
I kind of get the lack of faith in the latter, or the fear of the latter.
Right.
Because I think the fear is, no matter what we do, no matter how good it is for people, money will spend so much money to demonize us that the only way to win elections is through the old model of a competition between we raise enough money, the other side raises, and that if we throw in with people, we don't have resources to run the campaigns, people will be misled and we will lose.
I get that that's the calculation on the part of the party and the donor base.
Yeah.
Like that, I get it. It makes sense. I mean, we can pretend that they're, you know, that it's ideological capture or whatever, but really it's just corruption at the end of the day. That's all that is. And I get that from their point of view. What I struggle with is talking to my in-laws, my family, my friends, the people I live around, the parents at my kid's school, who sincerely, till their dying breath, believe that the Democrats are the good guys and the Republicans are the bad guys, and it's this pitched battle between good and evil. Why do you think it's so hard for professional class Democrats to see through this stuff? Why is there just this little, there's like you and Taibbi and Greenwald and Chris Hedges and some people over there going like, you know, it's not hard to find, you know, but why is that so repellent to professional class Democrats in 2021?
It's such a good question. And I think there's two answers. I think one, we live in a almost an ESPNized culture of my team, your team.
Yeah.
It's sort of a followership culture. You know, I mean, look at Twitter, for instance. Twitter, people follow each other, right? Like,
right.
It is a very, like, I follow, I'm on a team. It almost how you organize your world, right?
Yeah.
The world is chaotic. Well, at least I know I'm on the blue team, they're on the red team, and politics is basically just a battle. But it's a simplifying thing. I think the other answer is about the specific demographics you're talking about, is that if you're a, whatever you want to call it, affluent Democrat, professional class Democrat, the system isn't necessarily, or the Democratic agenda, or more specifically, Democratic surrenders on economic issues is not necessarily a life or death matter for you.
Sure.
It
works well.
It's not so bad for you, right?
I get that, but it also is directly responsible for creating all the chaos that
everyone's
asses on fire about. It's like, how can you not connect the dots that not bailing out homeowners led to the rise of MAGA world and all, you know, Trump all that? Like, that's
of course
it's not, this stuff isn't hard to figure out.
It's not, but I think there's also the idea that, listen, the Republicans are so much worse. I'm giving you the, you know.
Right.
The Republicans are so much worse. Donald Trump is so much worse that, yeah, maybe the Democrats aren't perfect, but you're you know, like, that's like having a, you're saying, to use Star Wars metaphors, you're saying that this or that faction of the rebels aren't that great, but we really got to focus on the Empire, on
but
Darth
the,
Vader.
The problem, the hole in that logic, and I get that you're not saying
I'm
that's
not saying
your
that.
Thing, but I understand that that's the way people view it, it doesn't hold water when your party's policies are directly responsible for the bad guys.
Yes,
rising in popularity.
Well, look, that's why I've used the metaphor in the past that politics increasingly feels like, and you got to be. I've been in this for 20 plus years, so I think I've reached that level of not deluded cynicism, but properly cynical, which is
just the right level of cynicism.
Just the right level of cynicism, yeah. Which is more and more you wonder, like, is this a game between the Harlem Globetrotters of evil, the Republicans, and the Washington Generals?
Right.
Where the fix is kind of in.
Right.
And by the way, that they both need each other.
Yeah.
Right? They both... That the Democrats need the Darth Vader, and the Darth Vader relies on the Democrats doing a weak job to then... Right, like, this pendulum swing is...
The pendulum swing, and you say it, and I think it's the last episode of Meltdown, where you said something to the effect of, like, government that doesn't govern,
right.
Change elections that garner no change, and a total lack of faith in institutions of power. So, you know, something...
Yes, and that's how we swing back and forth, and that's
right.
How the Republicans... Right, if you... And to put it specifically in the terms that we use in Meltdown, which is that if you have a charismatic president or candidate who becomes president promising hope and change, and that president raises expectations, then he and his party get into power and deliver effectively more of the same.
Right.
Lots of people are going to be mad. And it's not logical that the Republicans should benefit from that, because it's not like they're offering so much better of an agenda, but people will continue voting for change. And I think the danger here and why it's so relevant now is if the Democrats repeat that history now and don't really deliver real material help to millions of people, it once again creates the conditions for Republicans to say, you see,
right,
you voted those guys in, they
didn't
deliver.
Well, considering what they've done with their time so far, what's the likelihood that they deliver in the way that we're talking about before the midterms?
I mean, is
that even possible at this point?
The so-called reconciliation bill, which is basically a fancy word for their spending package.
Right.
It has been very, very watered down. I think it's not enough. It's not even minimally enough. I don't think it's enough for them to be able to go to voters and say, the old Reagan question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
Right.
I mean, I think even if empirically that question is answered in the affirmative modestly,
yeah,
first-term, midterm elections are difficult for a president's party.
Anyway.
You want to be going in there being like, look at all this stuff we delivered.
Right.
Like, boom,
right.
Boom, boom, we delivered that. Paid leave, expansion of Medicare, all these things. So you can at least say, I know this is going to be a tough election anyway, but just ask yourself. And my concern, not for the party, but for the world. Because here's the thing. I am the opposite of an apologist for the Democratic Party, but Republicans taking over is apocalyptic.
Right.
I mean, at least the Democratic Party, I'm no defender, great defender of the Democratic Party, but at least it can have a discussion about science. At least, the Republican...
Well, it can have a discussion about science when science can be weaponized against their ideological opponents. That's really what the
sure, but
purpose
you have to
of science in Democratic politics
sure,
is
I
for.
Agree with you, but you have to acknowledge that they're a... I guess there's more opportunity
right.
to push them kicking and screaming to do vaguely rational things.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, the comparison I always make is it's like you've got a brain tumor and you go to the Republican doctor and they're like, brain tumors don't exist. Here's a carton of cigarettes. Have fun. Right? That's sort of climate change on the Republican. And the Democratic doctor goes, oh, we're going to take 2% of your tumor out. And you're like, but I'm still going to die. Well, what are you complaining about, you know, crybaby progressive?
Right, right.
That's,
right.
I mean, it's marginally better. It doesn't really, they're not really offering anything that's going to solve anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But I
totally agree. I mean, I want to make clear, because people get confused about this all the time. Like, I come from a left-wing worldview, and like I don't say these things because I'm pro, you know how it is, you get called a de facto Trump
you're saying
supporter
they're both the same,
right,
that means
and
you're
I'm not
Trump,
saying
yeah.
that, I'm really not, I really focus on the Democrats and beat them up because that's where I live. You know, maybe if I lived somewhere else, I'd be, you know, I'd be think, you know,
yeah, but also
with Republicans or whatever. But and my expectations from the Republican Party are so low.
Right. But but you go back to that metaphor about the Harlem Globetrotters and the Washington Generals. If the Washington Generals are the only team that's being put on the floor right now,
yeah,
on the basketball floor, you need them to deliver because they're your only
right,
weapon
right,
against the Harlem Globetrotters. Now, you can say, oh, a third party, and I'm, you know, that's a longer-term project.
Sure.
But right now, in the here and now,
yeah,
all you got is the Generals, and I would say this is not a defense of the Generals. Like, there are more tools available to leverage and pressure them to deliver marginally better things,
sure,
than the Republicans, which there's right, no leverage to push them. They have no shame. How do you shame a Republican senator into doing something rational?
Right. I mean, yeah. No.
It's just not a thing.
Yeah. It's good for their brand.
Yes. Like even in the reconciliation debate, you saw. It's not some great victory, but three Democrats tried to kill the drug pricing stuff. They got shamed. They faced pressure at home. Voters were mad at them, and they ultimately agreed to a really crappy compromise. But at least something's getting on the books because they were shameable.
Right.
If that's a Republican legislator,
yeah,
that Republican legislator is just not shameable at
right,
all. Like,
sure.
And I agree. Like, it's kind of pathetic that we're living in the year 2021 and in the richest country in the world, you have to shame and, you know, do everything you can to get the Democratic Party to deliver like a crumb.
It's hard to wrap your head around because it's such an obvious point that if elites just gave a little bit.
Right.
I mean, the Democrats would rule forever. They would never lose another election if they just a handful of things, you just took a little bit out of their donors' yeah, pockets and spread the wealth a little bit. I mean, it's so obvious. And
we know it's obvious because from FDR's time.
Of course. But it's so funny now, post-2008, you're not allowed to say that in polite Democratic circles.
You're not.
That income inequality is the driving force of Trumpism.
No, you're not.
No, because it's only racism.
Yeah, yeah.
And not to discount racism. Of course, that was part of Trump's message and part of his appeal.
I've said this and I don't know if I've gotten in trouble for it, but it's apparently a controversial concept. You know, this whole question, well, was 2016 because of racism, or was Trump elected because of racism? And the answer is yes. And by that, I mean, yes, obviously racism helped Donald Trump. The question is, why was racism so salient in the 2016 election? Why, for instance, did 200-plus counties go from Obama to Trump?
Right.
You just can't say that that's...
Well, what's left out of that is the class analysis that's left out of it. Because
yes,
when people are hurting, and you cannot discount a lot of this country has been disenfranchised over the course of my... I don't know how old you are, but I'm 50 years old. So over the course of my lifetime, you see a huge... All these people that were the bedrock of the Democratic Party who have become, you know, rock... solid Republicans or MAGA people, whatever, those were the Democrats. And yes, their concerns are valid,
yes,
to an extent, economically.
Yes.
You know, they have been disenfranchised. And when people are in that position, they scapegoat people who they perceive as being, you know, lower down the totem pole
when
from them.
We know.
They scapegoat yes, the other. So racism is 100% connected to income inequality in
yes,
that sense. I mean, you cannot take those,
when,
you know, resources, separate those two things.
When resources are scarce, in-group solidarity strengthens, hostility to the other intensifies.
Right. And then you bring in, like, you know, the sort of right-wing media.
To stir the pot.
And, you know, and people turn to demagogues. I mean, it's just like, I feel stupid even having
it, it's
to,
like
to
the
point
most obvious
out,
thing.
Right. But let me tell you something. Where I live, I don't know where you live, but where I live and the people that I live around, they don't think like that.
They don't see the connection.
Not at all. It's just...
You just,
Trumpers
just,
are race,
just everybody
bad
woke
racist,
up
they're the bad people, and, you know, yeah, these people...
A bunch of Trumpers woke up on 2016 and were like, I'm racist.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's I don't even think it's that. It's that they always were, whatever. But they don't look at the reality, like you said, the
200 counties,
right? All that.
I mean, there was
they don't look at like in the 2020 election, the fact that Trump like doubled his numbers with African American voters, with LGBTQ. I think the only people he lost votes with were white men, ironically.
Look. Alex Gibney, who was the executive producer on Meltdown with me, and I, we wrote a Rolling Stone op-ed when Meltdown came out.
Yeah.
And it focused in on some studies, or it had some references to some studies from Weimar Germany. And these studies are fascinating and terrifying, because Weimar Germany was the post-World War I German republic before the Nazis.
Sure.
And the Germans kept very, very good records. They're notorious for keeping all sorts of records. And you can look at the voting data county by county in Germany, which counties flipped the hardest to the Nazis. And the counties that flipped hardest to the Nazis were the areas in Germany that were hit hardest by austerity, by budget cuts, by cuts to Social Security. They were also the counties where deaths of despair were increasing at the highest rates. Deaths from overdoses, suicides, et cetera, et cetera. The point being that shows a connection between, if you put people under economic stress, create and desperate conditions exist, typically those communities are therefore more open to racist, anti-Semitic, xenophobic appeals. That it's not racism, xenophobia, and the like does not exist on a binary scale. It's not you're a racist or you're not, if we're being honest. It's much more of a continuum, a sliding, what comes out in any conditions. Yeah. And what's, I think, scary about that, for many reasons, I mean, I'm Jewish, it's, just from my own heritage, that's a terrifying realization. I think the scary thing for us all should be, and the lesson for us all should be, if you keep the working class of any country, but in particular the United States, because we're here, if you keep the working class starved of resources, and you're making public spectacles of giving the wealthiest people in the country lots of resources, what do you expect is going to happen?
Right.
The right is going to jump in and start stirring the pot and making racist appeals based on and seize on that desperation. And the only way to break that cycle is to do, and we talk about this in the op-ed, which is to do what FDR did. And the really interesting thing is, when you go look back at speeches from FDR, you can see that he recognizes this specifically, meaning he is advocating for the New Deal, saying it is not only morally correct to help people who are struggling, it is not only good macroeconomic policy to rebuild the economy, but if we don't do this, fascism, which is back then was rising in America, fascism will take over. He had this quote, I'll paraphrase it because I'll butcher it, but he basically said, he was talking about other countries in the late 1930s, and he said, it was one of his fireside chats, and he said, a number of countries have decided to have moved away from democracy, not because people necessarily don't want democratic rights, but because they see democratic governments, small d democratic governments, dysfunction, only helping the rich, et cetera, and ultimately, many of those populations decided to sacrifice democracy in order to get something to eat.
Right.
And that should be the haunting message of both FDR and also what happened from 2009 to 2010, when Obama came in, did not deliver for the working class. The Tea Party ultimately won, and then that ultimately became the MAGA movement and Donald Trump. That people will make change. People will not necessarily care about your arguments for quote unquote democracy if they see democracy not delivering. People will vote for what they perceive to be to get something to eat.
Well, it's interesting. Do you think that part of this, and maybe this is a difference between the New Deal era citizenry and now, do you think that part of it is that people have been conditioned here for so long, You know, so that what's the old Reagan line, like the government
yeah, absolutely.
Is the problem or what? Yes. You know, right.
The nine scariest words in the English.
There's no connection. The government really doesn't even play a role in your day-to-day life in that way. There has no ability to solve problems for you.
Well, that's the self-reinforcing genius or evil genius
right.
of the right-wing argument.
Right. And
the
well, but I push back on that. That's not just a right. I mean, we have
no,
to,
no, I
as,
agree.
As lefties or whatever, we have to accept that our side, the Democratic Party, 100% bought into those economic ideas.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, 100%
but
on
when
board
I say,
with,
to be
you
clear,
know, think about the Clinton administration and the end of small, big government.
For sure. When
of,
I say, right. but let me be clear with my language. When I say the right, I'm not only talking about Republicans.
Right, right,
I'm talking
right,
about
sure.
the right of center, whatever you want to call
right,
it.
Right, right.
And that the self-reinforcing cycle of their argument is they get into power, they starve government. Government doesn't deliver. That creates people's frustration about government. That creates more, well, we got to get rid of more government. It's a reinforcing cycle of a downward spiral
yeah.
where the failure of the government justifies cutting the government, which creates more failures, which justifies more cutting. Or at least that's how it goes. And so, yes, I certainly think that we now live in an era where, fair or unfair, the perception that the government can govern, can deliver good governance and deliver simple, easy to understand, easily accessible help to people, that's just not a part of our expectations anymore.
Right.
And that's, I'm not blaming people for having it not be their expectations, because there's not a lot of...
It's confirmed in their day-to-day
yes.
experience with government.
Yes. Although I will say this, that there are some examples recently of the government actually doing things that kind of should be a positive model. Example, there was a recent study out about this, which was that the TARP program, the top-down bailout under Obama and Bush and Obama, that was this huge fund of money that they decided to give to a handful of financial institutions rather than giving it to millions of homeowners or spreading the wealth, if you will. They could only perceive a top-down solution to the financial crisis. So the experience of that for the average person is, I'm getting thrown out of my home, and I'm hearing on TV Obama's saying that he's fixing everything, and all I see is him handing out checks to the rich guys who created the problem. Right? That's a political failure that's going to create the kind of anger that created the Tea Party. Now, fast forward, I think it was 10 years, the PPP program. Not a perfect program. We're talking about the Paycheck Protection Program, where millions of small businesses were given money to float them through the pandemic. Granted, different situation, different. But sure. That was a bottom-up, if you want to use the term bailout, that was a bottom-up bailout. It was actually pretty simple. It actually delivered money to people very quickly. It was not perfect. Some companies and businesses shouldn't have gotten money that they got. Totally. But you look at the popularity of the PPP in polls, very popular. TARP, the bank bailout, wildly unpopular.
Sure.
Biden's child tax credit, wildly popular, because it's simple. They're now putting it straight into your bank account. It's a direct, you don't even see a piece of paper, and people love it. And actually, there was a stat. It's fascinating. I mean, it's fascinating because it's fascinating because it's shocking. It shouldn't be shocking that even self-identified Trump voters, the self-identified Trump voters who got the child tax credit have a much higher, say they have a much higher approval rating of Joe Biden than Trump self-identified Trump voters who didn't get the child tax credit. In other words, people received a benefit. They knew it was from the government. They knew it was from the Biden administration. And there's a certain segment of people who are like, you know what? Joe Biden's doing a good job.
It's interesting. So I'm curious to see how that resonates, you know, with voters ultimately, because I tell you what I hear from a lot of, and it's connected to that, from the people that I live around.
Yeah.
And if any of the people I live around are listening, sorry, I keep bashing you, my friends and family, but it is really interesting. I find this really fascinating. Democrats, liberals, where we are, complaining about these lazy workers that don't want to work and the labor shortages and the PPP money was, you know, they just want to collect their checks and not work. So I'm it'll be interesting to see who that resonates with. It's not resonating with professional class Democrats. I can tell you that.
Because that class of people didn't need it.
Right.
The people who needed it, that's who it was for. And I think
right. Will that?
I mean, I was kind of eye rolling or huffing when you said, you know, wage inflation and the like. I mean, that entire conversation is a microcosm of the problem we're talking about. The idea that somehow higher wages, this is a problem, is so. And have you noticed? I'm guessing you have. Have you noticed that the wage inflation conversation has focused on the Arby's worker making an extra 50 cents an hour, not on the Wall Street guy getting... I just read today.
Yeah.
Wall Street bonuses are at their highest record. Why isn't the wage inflation conversation about that?
Right. Why is it baked into the cake that's legitimate?
That's fine.
But the guy... Apparently. Right. But the guy working that wants to, you know, organize a union at Starbucks...
Yes.
That's the bad guy because he's fucking up your latte. Yeah. Your ability to get your latte.
That's...
By the way, do you want some water?
That'd be great. That in a nutshell, is the problem.
Right. But the problem... Man, and I hate to keep harping on this, is those are Democrats that feel that way. That's how disconnected from the working class and the middle class and working people this party is.
Absolutely. And I think that the...
Before people light me up on Twitter, I get that that's also conservative saying those things.
Yeah, I get it. In Meltdown, we have that quote from Chuck Schumer that really blew my mind towards the end of the 2016 election campaign. Where he says out loud, proudly, at a Washington Post event, he says, for every working class Democrat we lose in Western Pennsylvania, we will get two Republican swing voters in the suburbs of Philadelphia. I grew up in Philadelphia. I live in Denver now, but I grew up in Philadelphia. And then he says, and that will replicate state after state after state, which is exactly what didn't happen.
Right, but I think the thing that's so profound about that statement, that's who these people see themselves as.
Yes.
As they see themselves and their party as moderate Republicans.
Yes.
And therein lies the problem that we're talking about.
100%. What was amazing about the quote was that he said out loud what they had previously winked and nodded and said in quiet tones.
Right.
And it said our self-image of our party is a party, to use Pennsylvania for those who know it. Our party is not a party of working class people in the Western industrialized, former coal towns and the like. Our party is a professional class party from the wealthier suburbs of Philadelphia. And now look, now the issue is that in 2020... That was essentially the coalition that won. They got a certain share of the white working class. They managed to cobble it together.
I think,
with the wealthy suburbs,
right? But it was like, you know, you had the pandemic, and you had
I totally agree.
Had Trump's
it's a risky
what would have happened if you remove the pandemic from that election.
Is not a durable coalition.
Right.
By that I mean everyone, Biden won, Trump was. I look at the 2020 election and say every single possible thing had to go right for the Democrats in using that formula, the wealthy suburb formula, if you will. Everything had to go right for them to barely eke it out.
Right.
Like, it had to be Donald Trump, a ridiculous person, a pandemic. Everything had to... And he almost won.
Right.
So the point is that their formula for winning is predicated on, the most perfect conditions for it to even barely win. What happens in a normal election, where it's just a quote-unquote normal Republican, there's no pandemic, it's just a quote-unquote regular election.
Yeah.
You know what happens?
We're probably going to find out in 2024, unless it's Trump again. Who knows?
Right. You know what happens in those situations? You get another 2016, is my view. Or at least you raise the higher possibility of a 2016. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, we kind of just jumped right into this, and I wanted to set it up for people listening. So, with your podcast, so can you kind of break down for people that haven't listened to Meltdown yet, like the Reader's Digest version,
sure.
or not the Reader's Digest version of the you know the 2008 crash and the Obama administration's response to that, and sort of how that led to right. where we're at now.
So. Meltdown, as we say at the beginning of it, it is not just the financial crisis. Meltdown is what happened immediately after the financial crisis. Basically, a loss of faith in the government, a loss of faith in democracy, and a essentially first the Tea Party and then Donald Trump's ascent. And that it was Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's consigliere, who said at one point, "The legacy of the financial crisis is Donald Trump." That's a direct quote. And for all that we've talked about up until this point, the Democratic Party has not wanted to talk about that. They've wanted to blame the 2016 election on everything from Russia to racism to Facebook misinformation, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
And but the real story, it's not that those things didn't have whatever marginal or not marginal. I mean, racism was a real factor, but you have to understand all of that in the context of the frustration that existed. That any factor you bring up, misinformation, racism, was in the cauldron of a massive financial crisis happened. Millions of foreclosures. And while people were promised help in this change election of 2008, expectations were raised, promises were made, people are hurting. The Obama administration ended up delivering a way too small stimulus bill. It ended up watering down and essentially helping Wall Street lobbyists gut Wall Street reform. It had a bailout that it had full unilateral authority over to do what it wanted. That was basically a blank check. And they used it to prop up a handful of financial institutions that had created the problem. And they didn't prosecute any banker who was involved in engineering the crisis. So from the average voter's perspective, the average voter has either been foreclosed on, knows somebody who got foreclosed on, lost their job, or at minimum knows a lot of people who lost jobs. They're turning on their TV. They're seeing Obama say, I'm fixing everything, I'm delivering on my promises, and then they're seeing him hand a big giant check to Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and not doing the things that he promised, like prosecute bankers, like deliver real significant aid to people. And so what did you expect was going to happen? And what happened was a meltdown, which is a meltdown in people's faith that the government, people's last remaining faith, that the government could swoop in and deliver help to millions of people. What the government essentially was saying to people in that time was, we are going to enrich the rich and continue empowering the powerful. Or at minimum, we are here to preserve the status quo. We are here to prop up, to re-erect the financial system. And you, the people, are foam on the runway. And I use that
foam
term
on the runway.
I put that in quotes because yeah. that is a quote from Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, who, as you'll hear in the podcast, at one point, in one of the characters in the podcast is the Inspector General of the TARP program. He's the overseer of the TARP program. And he says, Tim Geithner.
Borofsky?
Yeah, Neil Borofsky. Tim Geithner turned to me, Borofsky, and Elizabeth Warren at one point. She was one of the overseers of the bailout too. And he said, what you don't understand is we're only slowing, I'm paraphrasing here, but we're only slowing down the foreclosures. We're not necessarily focused on ending foreclosures because what we're trying to do is foam the runway for the banks.
For the banks.
In other words, right. The banks are the plane and people's homes, really people, are the foam to help the banks land. Right. As opposed to people are the plane. And the banks should foam the runway for people.
Sure.
But a Democratic Party that was elected, whose presidential candidate was elected with the largest amount of Wall Street money in the history of presidential campaign politics, his administration saw people and homes and communities as the foam for the banks.
It's, you know, there were several things that I learned in Meltdown that I somehow had missed through that time. Because, you know, I was reading all the, you know, Taibbi and Diane and all the stuff, that all the people that were writing all that stuff. But one of the things you touched on, you know, the federal help to the banks and returning billions of dollars unused TARP funds that could have gone to homeowners. I mean, I think that might be the most important nugget from the whole thing. What would the political landscape be today had they used that to help people stay in their homes?
So for people who don't, this is lost history, man. And it's like, it's so incredible. You know, the Obama administration's argument on a lot of things was we couldn't do X, Y, and Z because the Republicans were in opposition. Now, let's remember, even on that argument, they had 57, 58, 59 votes in the Senate.
By the way, this is one of my favorite things that Democrats tell themselves, that Obama, he came into office. Right. By the way, this applies not just to Obama, because they always say, oh, the Democrats, they're just bad at, you know, they just get pushed around by the big mean Republicans. But Obama in particular, I remember this very clearly. This was always the out. Man, he wanted to do the right thing, but he was a greenhorn. He was this young, wet behind the ears guy. He just had to spend all this time fitting in. There was that one too. Like, he was black. I mean, I had people say that to me. Like, he was black. He had to fit in. It's like this weird, like, upside down kind of racist
bizarre. I've always said this, like, with the Democrats when it comes to the presidency, the day before the election, the presidency is the most powerful office in the entire world. We have to win. This is the most important election ever. And the day after the election, when they win, the president has no power to do anything.
Yeah, what would you expect him to do? He's just the president of the United States.
He has no power. He can't do anything. So the Obama administration has said, we didn't have the power. The Republicans could stop us. But the TARP program, the bailout, was a blank check to the president. The administration could do whatever it wanted with that money. In 2009, Obama, there were still $300 to $400 billion left in the TARP program. And the Democrats and their president could have basically said, all right, we're going to take this $300 or $400 billion and we're going to directly help homeowners. They could have done that. And instead what they did was the Republicans were running around saying what they always say, oh, the Democrats are spending so much money. And, you know, all of a sudden, of course, before an election and after an election, the Republicans go from, if they're in power, spending is totally fine. And then after the election, nobody can, you know, everyone can't spend anymore. So the Republicans were doing that cynical dance, saying, oh, the Democrats are spending too much money. Their deficit spending is all horrible. And the Democrats, instead of saying, like, basically, you know, fuck off, the Democrats said, oh, we're going to take this as a good faith argument, and we're going to show the public that we can be just as Republican as the Republicans.
Right, and also in their desperation to appear bipartisan.
Exactly.
Or, you know, have consensus on this issue.
Exactly. So they passed a bill rescinding the $300 or $400 billion. They passed a bill to not let their own president spend it so that they could run out and be like, look at us, we're fiscally responsible. Now, that may sound great in media or in Washington that's completely out of touch with, you know, the world, but the average voter who's getting thrown out of their home, they're just like, I need help. Like, you're just going to rescind your ability to help? I mean, think about what kind of world would we live in if, instead of saying we're going to meet the Republicans on their argument, Obama and the Democrats said, we're going to take that $300 or $400 billion and we're going to make sure we're going to reduce foreclosures by 5 million.
I welcome your hatred.
Exactly. You're screaming at me and I'm helping people.
Right.
But they didn't do that.
Right.
And then insult to injury, right after that, they turned to trying to cut Social Security.
Right.
Well, it's like, how long do you expect to be a boot kicking the face of the working class over and over again until the working class says, fine, we'll vote for the human bomb. We'll vote for Donald Trump.
I mean, sadly, I think with Obama, I mean, that was all there. I think we all projected things onto him that we just wanted to see, because it's all there even from before he's elected. You know, you know, waxing lyrically about his love for President Reagan and all, you know, well, all you that remember stuff. It's all in there.
You listen to Meltdown. You remember my interview with him? That's one of the things. There's a never before aired interview between me and Obama where he essentially says,
from before he's president,
basically makes clear he's not a revolutionary. He doesn't see himself.
The most infuriating part of the whole podcast was I think it was the last episode where it might be a snippet from his audiobook.
Yes.
Where he's spinning the fact that they didn't prosecute any of these people for securities fraud or whatever they could have done, and he's spinning that as protecting the little guy.
Yes.
We took care of, like, basically saying, you know, we gave all these billions and trillions of dollars to these banks in the interest of the American homeowner. It's such an absurd.
And he said the phrasing, because he's a good writer.
Yeah.
And he said it would have required a violence to the social order.
Right.
To prosecute the bankers. And what is really amazing about that, the social order had been violently abused by Wall Street.
Yeah.
And even today, Obama tries to defend his decisions by saying, I was really worried about violence to the social order. And I would argue that he protected the people who did the most violence to the social order.
Well, also, I mean, I really can't encourage people to listen to this enough, because there's a lot of like granular detail. But when you get into how the Obama administration itself was working behind the scenes again, you know, to shoot down
its own promises.
Right. I mean, it's like, come on. And that's where we get back to kind of where we started. It's like, is it corruption or is it ideology? Do they really believe this stuff?
Well, Neil,
it's hard for me to have faith that. You know, he really sincerely believed that was the best option. Come on.
Neil Barofsky, we asked him the exact question. Was it corruption? He's literally in Meltdown. This is the head of
How did you get him to participate anyway?
He wrote a book called Bailout.
He did?
Yeah, he wrote a book that was sort of about a lot of this. And he said...
So he's already on record.
Yeah, I mean, because
when I heard him in your thing, I thought, I don't know what his relationship is to the Democratic Party now, but it won't be good after this.
Yeah, you're right.
He's definitely not getting hired at a hedge fund.
That's right. And he said, we asked him, he said it's not corruption. It's that this is the way he put it. These are people, the people who populated the Obama administration, and I would say by extension, the people that run the Democratic Party, the professional class Democrats. They are surrounded by fellow professional class Democrats. It is a world view. If you live and are immersed in that world, then it is a world that says a more radical program like the New Deal is not, quote unquote, not realistic.
Right.
That is what capture really is. It's that if your entire, I mean, it's like the David Foster Wallace metaphor with fish. Right, you ever hear that metaphor?
I don't know.
It's from one of his famous speeches where he, it's basically one fish swims up to the other fish and says, "Huh, water's kind of warm today," and the other fish says, "What's water?" Right. It's if you're immersed in something 24 hours a day, then that thing becomes your world. If you're a politician, and your day is going from hanging out with fellow politicians to raising money with your donors at fancy fundraisers to talking to lobbyists, and that's your world, then that is a world that is not connected, where you're potentially never hearing the desperation or the alternative policies to what you're hearing inside of that world. You're essentially, if somebody swims up to you and says, "Why aren't you pushing the New Deal?" Your answer is because the New Deal is not even in this water. Your answer is effectively, what is water?
Right.
I don't even know what that is. Right. That's not something.
Yeah. Well, man, there is so much more I wanted to get to. This is just an endless topic. I would love to interview you again.
For
sometime.
Sure. I'd love to do it.
I just like, I'm a really big fan. I've been a fan for a long time.
Thank you, man.
I'm so happy that this was my first in-person interview in so long.
I have to say, there's a number of my friends who now think that I'm cooler than I actually am because you liked my podcast.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, oh my God, go. Like, yeah. No way. Like,
I'm glad I could be of service.
Thank you. So, like, I now momentarily look cooler than I actually am. Good. So I really appreciate it.
All right, that was Mr. David Sirota. Make sure you check out his podcast, Meltdown. Subscribe to The Daily Poster, and when it comes out, make sure you check out the new Adam McKay movie that he co-wrote the story for called Don't Look Up. That's it for this week. We'll see you at some point coming soon. Not sure when. When we get to it. Adios, amigos!